Good evening and welcome to the Cycles of Change radio program here on April 25, 2013. I'm your host, David Katzmaier, coming to you live as I do every Thursday night at 8 p.m. New York time, 5 p.m. Pacific. Tonight, we're going to be talking about cycles in the market, cycles in the economy, primarily cycles in asset allocation. We're going to be speaking with our special guest, Richard Sootmeyer. Richard Sootmeyer is the Chief Market Strategist for ValueEngine.com and Niagara International Capital Limited, and he is the founder of Global Market Consultants Limited. Richard has been a professional in the U.S. capital markets since 1972, transferring his engineering skills to the trading and investment world. He earned a bachelor's degree from Georgia Institute of Technology and a Master of Science from Brooklyn Polytechnic University. He considers himself as a self-developed financial engineer. After working at Grumman Aerospace in the late 1960s, Richard became a U.S. Treasury securities trader in the primary dealer community in 1972. He became the first long-bound trader for Bosch in 1978, then formed a government bond department at L.F. Rothschild in 1981, helping establish that firm as a primary dealer in 1986. This experience gave him the insights to be an expert on monetary policy, which he features in his Value Engine newsletters and commentaries. You can find out more at valueengine.com. That's valueengine.com. No double E in that, valueengine.com. So here to tell us a little bit about the recurrence, the cycles, and deciphering this mass of technical information in this age of data is our special guest tonight, Richard Sootmeyer. Richard, are you there?
I am, David. How are you?
Oh, I'm very glad to be talking to you. I've been looking forward to this program myself because I want to understand a little bit more of asset allocation. Richard, I'm going to have some more questions about your illustrious background, but before we continue, can you tell us, in a basic overview of a definition, what do we mean when we say asset allocation?
Asset allocation is the percentage of your investable dollars that would be allocated to stocks, to bonds, to commodities. Those are the three main asset classes. And then asset allocation can also be in terms of bonds, whether it's corporate bonds, municipal bonds, or U.S. Treasuries. And in commodities, are you weighting it towards the energy commodities or towards precious metals, agriculture, et cetera? And then in stocks, what sectors are you going to be overweight in, underweight in, or avoiding?
Okay. Now, when you're analyzing asset allocation, are you doing this for the individual? Are you doing this for group investments? Or are you functioning on different levels when you take a look at this?
Well, I'm more of a financial writer now, David, so I have subscription newsletters that cover this, and I write an article once every Monday for Forbes.com, and I'm a daily contributor to TheStreet.com, and I appear on radio shows such as yours. I make investor presentations and do some blogging and so forth. In fact, if anybody lives in Tampa Bay on Monday evening at 8 p.m., you can go to the University of Tampa, and I'm giving an hour and a half presentation to the University of Tampa Investment Club.
And so what is the date of that event?
That is Monday, April 29th at 8:30 p.m., and it's open to the public.
And where will they find out more about that? Do they go to valueengine.com to get more details?
They would go to the University of Tampa website for that.
Very good.
Or they can send me an email, and I'll send a link, and my email address is rsuttmeier, S-U-T-T-M-E-I-E-R, at gmail.com.
Very good. And you do write in various places. And my goodness, the history of the places that you've written for. You had a weekly story on Forbes.com. You were a daily contributor to TheStreet.com and so forth. Aside from where the many places that you have and do write, what can you give us an overview of what it is that you're presenting to your readers?
Well, we're presenting components of market analysis, essentially. You know, Value Engine is a quantitative program, and it covers the fundamentals. And in the fundamentals, we have a valuation model. Essentially, every stock has a value price, a fair value, and that's defined as where the stock would be trading in a perfect world. And obviously, we don't have a perfect world. And this is the price that's based upon, you know, 20 pieces of fundamental data. Most notably, the key data is a 12-month trailing earnings per share, 12-month forward earnings per share, and a very important component is the yield on the 30-year treasury. And a lot of people don't recognize that as a part of a stock evaluation. And the simple reason is the higher the yield, the more competitive the U.S. Treasury is versus equities, and the lower the yield, the cheaper stocks are relative to that so-called risk-free investment. And that's the kind of environment we've had here with the Federal Reserve QE3 and QE4 going on.
And people tend to think of things in isolated term. Oh, I got a hot tip on a stock or something like that. Or they tend to generalize an entire category of bonds or equities or what have you. But you're looking you're analyzing the different aspects that give you the figures of any one of these elements, and then you're taking in the relative value by comparing them and seeing the motions of them all. Is that right?
Yes. And I used some very simple technical analysis, chart patterns, momentum readings, moving average. I don't look at the textbook full of algorithms, but I have my own proprietary analytics that I developed in the mid-1980s that come up with value levels and risky levels. In other words, if a stock or a market goes down, you want to buy at a value level or cover a short at a value level. And if it goes up to a risky level and you're long, you want to book profits or even establish a short position. Another component of Value Engine, which I should have mentioned earlier, is that we also have what's called the forecast model. And in this model, it takes that fair value calculation and comes up with a series of where the stock will be trading in different time horizons, the most important of which is 1 year. And this is where we get our ratings from. And it's a 5-engine rating is a strong buy. Project that stock's projected to gain 12% or more over the next 12 months. A 4-engine is a buy, rally 5 to 12%. 3-engine is a hold, no more than 5% down or 5% up. 2-engine is a sell, decline of 5 to 12. And 1-engine is a strong sell, decline of 12 or more. And you combine all of this stuff, and really when you look at all of this, you've got fundamentals as oil and technicals as water, and that can't be mixed too well, which is why I came up with my proprietary analytics, because regardless of what's going on, you can buy weakness to a value level or sell strength to a risky level.
Well, I'm a strong believer in technical indicators because there has been amazing discoveries made with that. When you project on whatever it is you're analyzing, are you looking strictly at the data that you compile, what is and has been happening, such as maybe taking moving averages, which have been proven very powerful? But in the process of doing things like that, are you also uncovering cycles and projecting on a cyclical basis as well?
The cycles are a result of the price action. You tend to have, you know, when you have the NASDAQ bubble in 2000, for example, the NASDAQ went parabolic. And whenever you have a parabolic, you never know how high something's going to go, but you know it's going to pop. and it's going to lose a lot of its value in a hurry. And that cycle of boom to bust goes on consistently in the market. You can always identify one. I mean, we had the Apple bubble pop from 700, and the stock nearly halved down to below 400 in a very short time period. So, and now I'm noticing that in consumer staples, some of these stocks are bubble-ish, if you will, like General Mills, Colgate-Palmolive, Kellogg, Kimberly-Clark, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and Procter & Gamble. They have gone way too far, but they're forming these parabolics where you don't know how high they can go, but when they crack big, and we saw Procter & Gamble start to crack this week, as well as Kimberly-Clark, as for an example.
And you identified the parabolics right away because you've identified the behavior patterns of anything you're analyzing over a period of time. So you're comparing the motion not just by itself, but by what you know it to be because you analyzed it over time. The projections for the rest of this year, Richard, let's do an overview on that. You've named some very specific stocks here, and that's detail. That's good detail. Do you have any kind of an overview in equities and bonds and everything for perhaps the remainder of this year? That's a tough question, but it is a very curious one.
Well, the if you look at Treasury yields, because I look at that every day, the yield on the 10-year and on the 30-year particularly, you know, they're the risk-free investment in this environment because you know you're going to get your money back. Mm, yeah. In 10 years or 30 years. And the higher that yield is, the less undervalued or more overvalued a stock becomes. And gold, I think the gold bubble popped. That's a bubble that has popped. I mean, we went all the way down below the 200-week simple moving average, which is a moving average I consider a longer-term return to the mean. Yeah. And we went below that 200-week for the first time since 2002. So that was significant. We're back above it, but it'll be key to see if we can hold above it in tomorrow's trade. Now, crude oil, that bubble went from, what, $147 a barrel down to the low 30s very quickly from the middle of 08 to the beginning of 09. So that's the bubble that has popped. And since then, since the middle of 09, oil has traded back and forth around its 200-week simple moving average, all based upon the day-to-day, week-to-week jiggers of the oil inventory numbers, the overseas supply issues that might occur from the Middle East, and all those kind of things, as well as speculation. And what a lot of other people don't realize is that, you know, the euro versus dollar, for example, that peaked in 08, 09, and actually the dollar has been the stronger of the two currencies for a significant amount of time now. And many strategists on TV still says weak dollar. It hasn't been a weak dollar. So there's a lot of time frame issues in here. And I look at things, I look at daily charts, I look at weekly charts, and I look at monthly charts. So that takes you from, you know, a long cycle view. For example, yes. when I looked at the stock market going back to 2002, and it was way down where, and then you had the crash of 87. That's a blip on that long-term chart.
Such a short-lived thing. The Dow actually closed up a few points by the end of the year in that case. It was such an aberration. But do you think that was computer trading going on back in 87 that might have done that? People following the same indicators, passing them around with similar programs?
I don't think that was the case. I go back and I think that right back then, each of the major Wall Street firms had significant arbitrage activities. In other words, they'd be long one stock against another, maybe Dell against Compaq, that kind of thing. And then there was a huge private, you know, the public. I think the railroad in Great Britain,
mm-hmm.
when that went public.
Ah, I don't remember, Richard.
Yeah, I think there was a railroad company, a public railroad company that was made into a publicly traded company, and it required a ton of capital by all of these firms, and they had to unwind arbitrages to raise the capital, and I think that's what propagated the crash of 87.
When you're looking ahead and making your forecast, and you have many, many indicators, and you do use moving averages and so forth, we do have a couple of negative signals. We have some hovering going on, maybe a little uncertainty in the gold right now. Are you using things such as on-balance volume as well? Are you integrating your price with the volume as you do your averages? Indicators. I'm thinking of Joe Granville type of methods right now. Is what's running through my mind.
No, what I use is one of the key things in my value engine database is that whenever you see more than 65% of all stocks overvalued, we define that as a valuation warning, a value engine valuation warning.
Yeah.
And that occurred in early March of this year. And it was shortly thereafter, in mid-March, that you saw the highs so far in the two markets that got us up there, Dow Transport on the back of Dow Theory and the Russell 2000, the small caps. And they stopped in mid-March, and then the slingshot effect, the Dow Industrials and the S&P 500 continued to new highs into April, around April 11th. And back then, out of 16 sectors, this is back in early March, out of 16 sectors, so many, 13 were overvalued by double-digit percentages, with construction leading the way at 23.7%. Overvalued, followed by consumer staples, followed by transports, followed by finance. And so I was very worried about those sectors and started to write about pending problems sector by sector, concentrating on a story in each one. And for example, I observed and created a pretty big spreadsheet where it showed, you know, I've been tracking. I cover the home builders once a month in a story on thestreet.com, usually right after the National Association of Home Builders comes out with their index, which has been stuck under neutral 50, even though it's been trying to get back to 50. It just hadn't been able to do it. And even though the home builders were overvalued, they were still rated buy. But then all of a sudden, after the February updates to our model, so many of them were downgraded from buy to sell, just like that. Where out of 160 stocks, 43 are rated sell, and another 26 are rated strong sell. And that corresponded to the, you know, 2 days after I wrote this article on the home builders, the home builder item that I follow, which is a symbol HGX, which is the housing sector index, peaked. And it traded all the way down until my next article. And then I wrote this article because, and in it featured the fact that two of them were back to buy ratings and the others were back to hold ratings, so I didn't have any more sell stocks. So I looked at the 10% correction that occurred in the housing sector and said, well, now you can buy and trade them again. And lo and behold, the housing sector index is very much closer to the high that we saw in March, actually it was March 20th, and I think I wrote this article on March 18th. And then the second one I wrote right around April 18th.
Well, you made a lot of good calls with Value Engine, and just as when you're analyzing a particular price that you're following, you're analyzing the short-term cycles, the mid, the long-term cycles, and when you make your forecast, it seems that you're also giving the overview of the sector, but then you bring it right down to the specific stocks, too, with details. So
exactly.
We're being able to see this on all different levels.
Yes, and that's what Value Engine and the technicals and the levels are all able to give you, you know, and even the transports. This was a very interesting sector this year because the Dow Transportation Average, I said that peaked in on March 19th, and I wrote about that on March 17th, and in this case, out of 186 stocks, you had 97 sell rated and 49 strong sell rated. And, you know, the transports came down pretty hard also there. And it got back down to some of my semi-annual and annual levels from my model for the Dow Transport Average. You know, and when these longer-term levels are violated, in my world, whatever that market is, a stock or an index, has an 85% chance of coming back to that level that it violated as a magnet until that time frame is over. So you're looking for reversal-oriented opportunities until you get the confirmation that the market has topped out right across all major averages and all major sectors. And right now that hasn't happened.
Indeed. You know, I like to ask you a question about the analytical process a little bit further, almost from a scientific attempt of scientific thinking towards this. Sometimes when you're looking at properties of matter, subatomic matter, you're going to find behaviors and tendencies that tend to exist. They live for a while, then they mutate and change form. And then you find other things that come into existence that you can identify with certain behaviors, and then they're gone. When you're looking at the many indicators that you're doing for any particular commodity or equity or what have you, or an entire sector, do you find that you can identify behaviors or cycles that develop for a while and then mutate into something else? Or do you find that there are underlying cycles with periodicity that are consistent in any particular area? Am I being too abstract with this question? I hope I worded that well.
Well, you know, I'm an engineer too, master of science and so forth. In terms of, you're right, you look for small cycles because it seems like there's always a theme of getting out of one type of stock into another, and it seems to be almost on a daily basis. Now, when I was making, just to finish the story, because this is the key to the story, you know, in observing the home builders and then the transportation stocks,
yep,
you'll never guess which popped up as the best place to invest. Utilities. Okay? That's where all the strong buy and buy rated stocks went to. 64 strong buys out of 215 utility stocks, 130 rated buy. In the whole universe, there's only 100 strong buy rated stocks, and 64 of them are utility stocks.
Good heavens.
So what did that tell me? It tells me that investors need to be extremely cautious. Invest where the dividends are and stay with brand names, because you still had at that time 14 Dow components rated buy, Dow industrial components rated buy. So if you're looking at brand name stocks in the Dow and utilities and you're raising your level of cash to 50%, that's where you're sitting right now in this market.
So avoid volatility and go with the tried and true inveterate giants, blue chip. Do you feel more comfortable in that area?
Utilities. Now the utility average has been setting multi-year highs almost daily since I wrote that piece.
Yes.
Including today. And then I looked back and said, okay, what happened in 2007, 2008?
Yeah.
The Dow and S&P peaked in October.
Mm-hmm.
And utilities continued to rally and did not peak until January. And that's what you're seeing now.
Hmm.
And so that's a cycle that's been, that's a cycle that's repeating.
Yeah. Yeah. So identifying a similar sequence.
Yeah. Now, also, in that time frame from October of 07, you had every sector overvalued by double-digit percentages. Now, swing forward into February of 09, when I'm, you know, pounding the table to buy the market, every sector was undervalued by significant double-digit percentages.
Wow.
You know, and that bottom happened so fast, you don't even see in any book of data where P.E. ratios got to single digit almost across the S&P 500. But since it happened so fast, that bottom, you didn't have that luxury of touting the P.E. ratios.
Yeah. Yeah. A short tip. Good heavens.
Yeah.
Good.
But well, you see, market timing, David, depends mm-hmm. upon the fundamentals, which I just outlined, and those fundamentals are overall valuations and the patterns you see among sectors. That's the fundamental key to timing a cycle change. On the technical side, I use what's called a 12x3x3 weekly slow stochastic, and if it gets above 80, that market is technically overbought, and if it gets below 20, that market's technically oversold. And we've been overbought now for quite some time, and there are some negative divergences starting to show where transports and utilities are now starting to fall below that 80 mark.
All right. Let me jump up to the overview here and ask you this. Is there a chance of us having pretty much a recession between now and spring of 2014?
I would say yes.
Yeah,
and I say yes based upon the fact that the transportation average is so cured to the sell side, and that's a leading indicator to economic growth. And I say that it's and also a sign because of the strength in utilities that we're, you know, you're still going to have your heat and air on and so forth. And then you look at the shifting from consumer discretionary into staples, and now the shift is going towards retail wholesale, which are your big box discounters.
Yes.
You see?
Yeah, and spending has been cut back by the consumer, and I am concerned about that, but, you know, maybe it's a cleaning out period that we have to have every now and then, as Schultz and Knitson said, maybe on a small fractal scale.
Right.
It's going to do us some good. How about real estate? Are you currently following any indicators in the real estate world with all the things that you do follow?
Well, I did a presentation in Orlando on Wednesday, and REIT came up, so REITs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked at the S&P Spider Dow Jones REIT symbol, RWR, and I noted in my presentation that it was trading at an all-time high that day.
Hmm.
And then I looked at scanned the 83 stocks or REITs that make up that index,
yep.
And there were only a handful of buys, and all the rest were holds.
Hmm. Hmm. Okay, so a bit of uncertainty there. So
absolutely.
You know, we got some, yeah, so this is going to be a tricky year. Would you advise people to be very conservative with their investments now? Maybe hold on. And you're saying, did you say 50% cash earlier?
50% cash at a minimum. I mean, if you aren't, you might be more uncomfortable than I am and have more in cash than that.
Sounds like wise advice. Folks, you're listening to the Cycles of Change radio program here at blogtalkradio.com/cycles. And we're speaking with Richard Sootmeyer, who's a chief market strategist, and we're discussing cycles and asset allocation. We're talking about some of the things that are covered and kept up to date on valueengine.com. That's valueengine.com. Well, Richard, as we look ahead, when most of your forecasts, are they usually within the next year, or sometimes do you make long-range forecasts as well? I know a lot of investors usually aren't as interested in the longer range, but what kind of projections do you often have for your readers?
It's the risk-reward for a calendar year. Also, and once we get towards the end of a calendar year, it would get more towards a rolling six-month horizon.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Okay. So.
Absolutely. And you have a newsletter, too, that comes out. How often does your newsletter come out, Richard?
Well, I have a daily markets commentary with tables and graphs, and then I have a one-page freebie that gets blasted out to people who subscribe to it on Value Engine. I have a subscription, Capital Markets Morning Briefing, it's called. That's the first one. And then I have a Value Trader Model Portfolio. And then I have an ETF report. And I have an FDIC report, which we haven't even touched on, because one of the things I developed in early 2006 was a unique analysis of the FDIC quarterly banking profile. Ooh. You know, that hardly even gets a mention on financial television. But when you think about the FDIC quarterly banking profile, it's every bank in the country. So in my judgment, what's going on in that profile is the balance sheet of the U.S. economy.
Well, that only makes sense.
The assets, the liabilities, all reported to the FDIC. So in this, as I started to look at it, I noticed that so many banks were overexposed to what's called construction and development loans, and that would be a problem for the banks. And then I was writing for realmoney.com back then in 2006, and I also was on CNBC frequently, and I wrote that, and actually by name gave a list of 50 banks that would fall like a domino over the next 12 months in April.
Another good call.
I mean, it was incredible. I mean, I looked at the housing market in May of 2005 and predicted the home builder stocks would go down beginning in the middle of the year, which they did. Then I looked at the banking system, and then I worked with this the FDIC quarterly banking profile, and the community banks peaked at the end of 2006, and the money center regional banks lasted until February before they succumbed to the downside. And
good analysis is seeing what everyone else has seen and thinking what no one else has thought. And the data is all here. It's all readily attainable, but there's no substitute for experience when it comes to analyzing it, putting it together, recognizing the behavior patterns, and seeing it in a relativistic point of view. But speaking of relativity, and looking at things, you know, not only from the individual equity to the sector to the national economy, Do you find that we're being affected more and more by the international arena? Is it there was this wonderful book that came out in the early 1990s, The World is Flat. Are we being influenced more by the Asian market? We're not as sovereign as we used to be. Do we have to take a look at those relativities as well when we're trying to make our forecasts and measure our sensitivities?
Well, you know, it's hard to incorporate that into my way of thinking because I really want to focus on the U.S. capital markets. Mm-hmm. And within the U.S. capital markets, in terms of equities, there are ADRs and there are ETFs for countries. So from the standpoint of a U.S. investor investing in a country, I can cover that. But to cover stocks around the world is next to impossible,
yes,
in my
is.
Opinion.
But you can feel the vibrations when anything is
happening. Oh, yes,
happening,
you feel the vibrations.
And then you make your production. Yes.
Yes. I mean, what the cause and effect of what goes on overseas that affects our market is part of the daily volatility. The result is part of the daily volatility that U.S. investors can take advantage of by having GTC limit orders to buy weakness to a value level on a stock they're tracking or a market they're tracking, and to have a GTC limit order to sell strength to a risky level in a similar way. And this way, even when we had that flash crash back in 2010 with the value trader model portfolio, there was like seven stocks that got filled at value levels
yes.
on the flash crash. And you wouldn't have gotten filled if you didn't have a GTC limit order.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. You know, when you're crunching the numbers on the many indicators that you follow, do you have specialized software that you're using for this? Or do you have your own in-house secret elves? You remember Louis Rukeyser? He used to have his financial
elves. Yeah. Actually, a value engine is a very robust system, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And it was originally developed by Chinese economists at Yale University.
Indeed.
And who did a lot of portfolio work. And certainly over the year, it's been tweaked by current engineers at Value Engine. My work is just plain huge spreadsheets.
Yes.
Okay. All the proprietary analytics, you know, I hit a few buttons from my Reuters screen into the spreadsheets, and it crunches new numbers, and it prints out what I want to see. And if I want to see something that wasn't printed out, I can always dig into it with a search.
Yeah, and tried and true methods used with modern tools has proven to be a very effective thing. You know, you mentioned the bubble bust around 2000. What was going on then when they had a lot of businesses just floating in the air? Everybody was the great mediator of the world, and some of these so-called businesses were nothing but a dot-com, and they were telephones and computers. And then after that went bust, and when the smoke cleared in 2001, the companies that were still around were the ones that were the brick in the click, the ones that actually had some intrinsic value to them, that they actually had inventory, they actually had services that they've been offering for a while. And I think that when you're following the technical indicators, you know, keep your tools modern, but some of the old tried and true methods of really just reading the data and knowing how to understand it is winding up to be the tried and true. And you're doing it in multifaceted way at Value Engine.
Yes, yes. You know, And when you're trying to time a market like I did in February of 2009 at that bottom,
mm-hmm.
or March 2009, I forget which now, whatever, what I did there was use Fibonacci retracement, which I rarely use. So I put it on to the market highs in 2007, dragged it down to where it was trading, and that low in March early March 2009 was exactly the 61.8% retracement.
Good heavens. And that's you're applying the Fibonacci retracement to the raw data, not the process data.
Right.
Oh, my goodness.
And then similarly, I then took a trend line from the low of the crash of 87 through all the other lows, and that lined up right at the same spot, too. So not only did you have a major trend that connected the last time we had a major crash in the market, right? It lined up perfectly, and so did the Fibonacci's.
The isomorphic recurrence of the Fibonacci sequence it never ceases to amaze me. Of course, we're talking about Fibonacci sequence, which was discovered on round 1200 by Fibonacci himself, who wrote Mathematicus Abacus after looking at, there was a puzzle about the replication of rabbit in a contained area, and then you would have you could put one and one together, and then they'll make another one that has three, and then they'll go on. You'll have 5, 8, 13, and on.
Yeah.
But that number sequence, there's a ratio between the sequence, the self-iterating sequence,
right,
that eventually works out to 1.618.
Yeah, let me correct myself, David.
Uh-huh.
You're right. It was the year 1202.
Oh, thank you. 1202, yes.
And the retracement, I think I said 61.8. It's really 68.2. I just misspoke because the first retracement is 31.8, and sometimes I slip of the tongue say it the wrong way.
But you knew what you meant, and for some reason that's what I heard. I heard what I was expecting, but you certainly know the figures on that. You know, I have a question. There's been some much talk and a little bit of popularity in looking at Fibonacci retracements, if you know where and how to look for them. Are you the Fibonacci ratio in anything other than retracements? Are there anything in moving averages or trend lines or anything like that? I always hear it applied towards retracements. Is that mostly where it shows up?
Well, what I did to determine my parameters, David, was right after the 87 crash, I was not applying my models to the equity market. It was all fixed income because I was a treasury strategist. I was at L.F. Rothschild. I was running the desk. So I wanted to build a model to help my trader handle the flow of business, okay? So after the 87 crash, I put in all the closes that I needed to check what predictive force I had in this model for the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Now this year, I have an annual level from my proprietary analytics for the Dow Industrial Average at 12,696. So my forecast is at some point this year, the Dow is going to test 12,696.
Uh-huh.
And why I say this is important is because in the crash of 87, and after I put my numbers to the test in the Dow back then, the same position in the model was within 5% of that low on the crash.
Yes, indeed.
Okay? So then I knew I had something. So now I had to say, okay, I have this graphics package automated. I now have to figure out what moving averages and what momentum readings work the best on daily, weekly, and monthly charts. And I stated an objective. What it was? To create the methodology of trend following that gave me the fewest false signals. Not the best signals, the fewest false signals.
Indeed.
Okay?
Yes.
Okay. And I came up with on the daily chart a 21-day, 50-day, and 200-day simple moving average. And the various crossovers you get there made the most sense on a daily chart. On the weekly chart, I came up with what I call the 5-week modified moving average and a 200-week. And on the monthly chart, all I needed was 120 months. Okay?
Yes.
Now, yeah, the modified moving average is similar to a lot of the algorithms in my proprietary analytics are based upon modified moving averages. But with a modified moving average, for anybody that doesn't know, you instead of adding in the last piece of data and dividing by 5, taking out the oldest data, you add in the new data and subtract out the prior moving average.
Okay. So it's not a simple moving average.
It slows it down.
Yes. All right.
Just a little trick in math.
It's brilliant. It's another case of seeing what everyone else has seen and thinking what no one else has thought. And to do that, you have to have the experience. And I appreciate you giving us civilians a bit of insight as to some of the coding that goes on in the magic machine, because it is very compound and very complex, but it all has simple elements once you learn them and have the experience on them. Indeed. Now, Value Engine... Are you working with other people at Value Engine along with what you're doing?
Well, Paul Henneman is the president of Value Engine, and Steve Hatch is an analyst, and then the rest of the folks are in support or are engineers, working to improve the site and massaging the numbers to make sure they get into the model, because every night from a reliable data source, we get all the new pieces of data that'll come out on every stock.
Wow.
If 10K data, 10Q data, you name it, it gets plugged in.
That's a lot to analyze, but that's teamwork for you, to be able to put all of that together. They say that the Great Depression could have been seen of the 1930s. You're not seeing any kind of indicators along those lines for us these days, are you, Richard?
What I worry about is Main Street USA hasn't gotten the help that Wall Street got. That's a concern of mine.
Yeah.
And the cost of living is a problem.
Yeah,
the Fed thinks they have inflation under control, but they don't have the cost of living under control. That's a big difference.
And the figures, there's more and more things that get left out of the cost of living assessment. If gasoline goes up too quickly, well, we're not going to follow that maybe, or eggs, we're not going to follow that. Whatever's spiking, that gets dropped from the equation.
the unemployment statistic. Some of the things that get me is, when consumer confidence will be out again, I think on Tuesday, and if it goes up a little bit, they're all cheering. Consumer's confident. But if it goes up from 60 to 65. And you know what neutral is? It's 90 to 110. So the housing market, the home builder index, it dropped from 44 to 42 in the latest reading, and you need to get above 50 to even say the builders are confident.
Tempest in the teapot, it is.
Yeah.
And what about the debt? Is the debt going to hover over us like a sort of Damocles and eventually start in breaking down the economy, or is that something yet for us to be seeing?
I don't know about the debt because, we're printing money. We can always print money. And $16 trillion, if you add in all the mortgages and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you're above $22 trillion. Because they're now guaranteed by the government, for crying out loud. So does it matter whether it's 16 or 22? Apparently not. So does it matter that it's growing? It never has. And I've been in this business since 1972, watching the debt grow constantly every year, and it hasn't really posed a problem.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, it's a different kind. We're not as much of an industrial economy. We're more service-related economy. It's much more sophisticated. It's not the same world that we were born into. We just have to abandon some of our paradigms, I think, while at the same time some of the traditional things are holding true. It's a difference is knowing which is which and adapting to that. That could be pretty complex for a common investor when they're just trying to say, well, I just want to pick one thing and sink some of my portfolio in that. So when you are analyzing all these details and all these different levels of time and sector to specifics and everything like that, you basically then just break it down to a person and give them some choices along those lines. Is that true?
Yes, yes. So, you know, you can get on thestreet.com, search my name, and the latest story will be up there. There's a story every day. There's a little twist of a theme every day, but I tend to update the themes, the important ones, once a month. Like I said, on the home builders, I'll do the regional banks once a month. I'll do transports once a month. I'll do oil services once a month. I'll do, you know, consumer staples once a month. Anything where I think the theme is important to keep track of in terms of, you know, the ebbs and flows of where the buy ratings are, where the sell ratings are, where the sector valuations are. It's important to do that. And
yes, indeed.
And when you see a stock, I mean, look, take Amazon today, right? It was up going into earnings. The earnings were extremely difficult to decipher right away. The first trade I saw in Amazon after market was $288 a share. 3 hours later, I look and it's $259.50.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we have that stock rated a strong sell. So I'm saying this is a source of funds, this stock, and when you have a pop to the upside, you're getting out of the stock. You're not chasing it. And that proved to be right in the after hours.
You know, as we follow these trends and we monitor their activity, they see what kind of hills these trains are moving on, are we able to do that because we have something of a herd mentality? I mean, this is a sociological question, if you will. Do we tend to move in groups? Is that why we have fads and fashion and so forth?
Yeah, well, this is why you see the volatility in the commodities markets. Several years ago, pension funds decided that they want to have a third asset class called commodities. So they get a hold of a company like Goldman Sachs and says, here, I got $100 million, replicate your index on a contract. So they give Goldman Sachs $100 million, and they get a contract saying your investment will match the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, correct? So now Goldman Sachs monitors that day to day and trades it leveraged using the pension fund's money.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
And that's why you probably had, with the decline in oil recently and decline in gold recently, you probably had some liquidations of that type of investment from the pension funds.
You know, a lot of what you're saying is consistent with a bit of a theory that I have at kalarhythms.org, K-A-L-A, rhythms.org. Where, among other things, I follow three main cycles within the United States, basically what I call the biorhythms of the United States. I don't want to sound new age, but I do believe that there's underlying trends that have been moving in us since we were born as a nation. And amongst them is a 28-year physical cycle, as I call it, and influences industry and durable goods, military readiness, and even health. And a 36-year emotional cycle, which influences speculation, whether we're having highs of Beatlemania or going down into lows of apathy in Generation X, and a 44-year intellectual cycle, which uses SAT scores and so forth and influences banking. Based on the 28-year physical cycle, which is due to be end a high period and go into crisis right now for this 1 year period, this spring until next spring. I'd written almost a year ago the recession of 2013, where I was calling for an industrial recession in the United States between spring of this year and spring of 2014, with a drop in the oils and a drop in all the metals and a cutback in production. And that's just based on the 28-year cycle. Now, you can't invest when you're looking at 28, 36, 44-year cycles. You've got to be able to do what you do, which is to take a look at the short, medium, and long-term trends and apply it to the specific areas and right down to the individual item which you want to invest. But it's very interesting to see, talking to you, a true specialist, that the timing and the things that you're saying is coinciding with a longer-term trend that I discovered back in 1978. It's from that time that I would predict that we'd have this industrial recession in 2013. That's yet to be borne out, but there's a little bit of congruency there. I was just tempted to throw in there, Richard, if I may.
Well, so I profess to the fact that buy and hold died, and now it's buy and trade. And cash is an important buffer.
Yeah.
And you know, if you took 50% of your money out of the market in October 07 and put that 50% back in March 09, why wouldn't you take it out now?
Yes. Yes. Wise advice. So the main place for people to find you is at valueengine.com, valueengine.com. You also have an email address. Richard, can you bring that email address again where people can just write to you directly?
R. Suttmeier, S as in Sam, U-T-T-M-E-I-E-R, at gmail.com.
Yes, and it's been a fascinating discussion for me, and I know how respected you are in the esoteric world of studying cycles. In fact, you were head of the Society for the Investigation of Recurring Events that used to meet regularly in New York City at the Princeton Club, and you had different speakers there from time to time, as I recall.
Yeah, I ran that from 2001 to 2009, and it's been in hiatus since.
Yes, and even the larger Foundation for the Study of Cycles, an entirely different group, went into a hiatus back in 1998 as well. But then, you know, things move in cycles. Even the research of cycles themselves is something that moves in cycles, because we do have a great group mentality, and we do have a mood, and we do move in trends. And that's why we can analyze the market, find that there's trends in everything that we do, including asset allocation. So, Richard, I want to thank you for coming on and telling our listeners a little bit about this. And I hope that some of you listening to this go out and find out a little bit more. Don't just take it on by yourself. They say if you're in a courtroom, that anyone that represents himself has a fool for a client. Well, same thing for the investment world. You know, there's some things that when my car doesn't work well, I take it to a mechanic. And when I want to know a little bit more about the economy, I talk to somebody who specializes in that. And I'm glad that the study of cycles has moved into this very important realm, because I, too, believe that it can be found in everything we do, including economy and asset allocation. Richard Suttmeier of valueengine.com, I thank you for coming on tonight and telling us a little bit and giving us some insights into the financial world.
Well, thank you, David, for having me on. And I enjoyed the conversation and so forth.
Yep, and we'll see what is down the road. And maybe a year from now, we'll meet again and compare some notes and see, take a look on the year that's gone by and take another forecast into the year ahead. I think that would be a good spring ritual. Richard, thank you so much for being on. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Right on. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. David Katzmeier here for the Cycles of Change radio program, signing out until next Thursday at 8 p.m. New York time. Thank you for listening.